Blog Talk Radio.
Tim Block Talk Radio, brought to you by Together in Ministry Network. We're building relationship, equipping the body of Christ, advancing the kingdom of God. Now, here's your host, Dwayne and Dennis Paris.
Hello again, Internet world. We welcome you in the world you are, whether it is good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thank you for taking the time out to join us. Today we have a really exciting show. We have one of our special guests. He's been on the show with us on a few occasions. He's becoming a very good friend at the moment and a mighty man of God. It's Bishop Dr. Joe Aldridge. And we're going to give him a chance to tell you a bit about himself. But as you can see, we'll be talking about his new book, which is called Thinking Outside the Box, on race, on faith, and life. Before we go into our show, we usually like to play you a song, and this is released, I believe it was last year, and it's from one of our best reggae gospel artists, Junior Tucker. Some of you may have heard him on the show probably a few months ago, it was. Yeah, when we had Junior Tucker. Remember, all our shows are recorded and can be accessed 24/7. So you can always go on our website, which is www.togetherinministry.org. And if you do a search for Junior Tucker, you'll hear that interview. Well, this is All Because of You by Junior Tucker. Enjoy.
Yeah, man. Is that about you, King Jesus? You're done, you know.
Tucker with All Because of You. You're listening to Together in Ministry Blog Talk Radio, and we have on the air with us, myself and Dwayne, we have Bishop Dr. Joe Aldridge. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back with you again.
Yes, it's always, we're always really excited to have you on there. I know you have a lot to share, and tell us a bit about yourself. And you can go into why you wrote the book, which is called Thinking Outside of the Box.
Well, I suppose I have one of those portfolios that some people describe as mixed. So my work revolves around me as an ecumenist. I'm a writer, I'm a speaker, and one or two other things. In terms of my main work as an ecumenical person, I work for Churches Together in England, which is the main ecumenical body that encourages churches to work together.
Yeah.
And my main work with them is supporting the growing black-led or black-majority church sector. And I do that nationally. Very exciting work. We had a very exciting week this week when we had a top-level meeting between the archbishops of the Roman Catholic Church and some senior black church leaders from across the country. We had a really great encounter there. So that's my ecumenical hat on with Churches Together in England.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a broadcaster myself.
Yes.
I didn't mention that just now, but I work for the BBC. I have a weekly show on BBC WM and Coventry and Warwickshire in the Midlands.
Yeah, that's on Sundays, isn't it?
Sunday night, 8 to 10, every
yes.
week, Nikki Tapper and I co-present it. And our great producer, Irene Assery, is busy pulling it together even as I speak.
Okay.
I also do some other things at BBC, like Prayer for the Day on Radio 4 and
okay.
Pause for Thought on Radio 2, plus other things. And I do write and speak.
Yeah, I was gonna I was wondering, with all the activities that you're doing, how do you actually get down to writing a book?
Well, this current book is my seventh book.
Yeah.
Some of them have been edited work because I have a commitment to see more writing done and published by black writers in the UK, so we can get a better balance of what is out there between the different cultures. How do I find the time? I suppose I tend to integrate a lot of what I do. So this book, for example, is a compilation of sermons I have preached, articles I have written, lectures I have given, and so forth. So if you imagine I'm very busy, but I'm going to give a lecture, as I did, let's say, at the New Testament Church of God's National mm-hmm. Convention, I tend to have an eye on writing it in a way that may lend itself to being published either in a book or on the internet or something.
Okay.
So I try to integrate what I do so that writing doesn't become such a chore, particularly for this book, which is a pulling together of various pieces of work that I have done. And alongside the writing, I suppose, the speaking career, which a couple of weeks ago I was in Geneva,
mm-hmm.
Being the weekend speaker of a church called Crossroads, which is in Geneva on the border with Geneva and France, Switzerland and France.
Mm-hmm.
They have some 40 nationalities attending that church because of
right.
the many world bodies that are there in Geneva, from which they draw their following. And it was a really exciting weekend of a speaking engagement.
Mm.
And I preach around this country as well quite a lot. So yes, it's a pretty busy life. And of course, on top of that, I'm trying to be a good husband. And
I was going to bring that part up.
Father to three grown daughters and three grandchildren
right.
as well, and lots of friends.
Right. Yeah. So do you pastor a church?
I don't. I have done. I've held about, I think, four pastorates in my life. The last one was 17 years ago. Actually, no, that's not true. I pastored for a brief while as a co-pastor at a Baptist church around 2003 to 2005. Didn't last very, very long. But before that, I'd been a pastor for about 14 years in three places.
Okay.
And I resigned from that. In fact, I was a regional bishop as well for the Church of God of Prophecy, still hold the title of bishop. But I resigned from that last post in Sheffield and the North to go into the field of ecumenical affairs, which I now still do with Churches Together in England.
Okay.
Oh, great. That's quite a lot. I understand you're still a young man.
Listen,
at least this picture says so.
Turning 60 last October is young, then I'm young.
Of course. A conversation for another forum.
I think so. What is young? Yes.
Yes.
Of course, if I were a member of the Kremlin of a few years ago, I would be young, wouldn't I? Because you didn't get to the top of the Kremlin until you turned to 80 or 90.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, that's one we need to explore, especially with things like people battling or the government battling pensions and stuff like that. Definitely don't have a solution for an obvious aging population. But back to thinking outside of the box. I think I'd like to start, I guess, with the very first chapter of that book, and I'll encourage our readers to definitely get the book. It's quite an interesting and engaging read. But the first chapter starts, "Black, I certainly am." And I find that, as I said, from the get-go, quite an intriguing and engaging read. And I think one of the comments, or I guess for me, I'm trying to paraphrase here, but I think one of the points you established and brought out quite well is the fact that, black people today believe that there might be, not all black people, that is, some black people, probably a significant amount anyway, feel that there might be something wrong with the whole concept or thought or the fact, actually, that they are black. And again, you further attempted to establish the fact that this might have been so because of the, I guess, lies that they've been sold by the white races or people who tend to actually hold that particular view. What the question I want to ask based on that comment, and this is really establish the other side of the view. I guess some individuals will indeed, that you've correctly probably identified, may have arguments to suggest that, one, they weren't always called black. Some may even go to the Bible and make comments like, the word Adam means reddish brown. And originally they're, I guess, reddish brown and not black. And as I said, the word black, as we know, have negative connotations. We know the stories, or at least some of the school of thoughts, that black and white, in terms of its definition, all engineered by the white man. And the fact that, I guess, Americans choose not really to call themselves black, but they would prefer to use the word African American. So I guess, you've made a point which I tend to agree with, but looking on the other side of the coin and trying to make an argument for those who may want to say, well, actually, I am offended because of how that word was defined. It was never a word that was used to describe me. In a sense, the whites have placed that word to describe me. How would you respond to that?
Quite a lot there. And
yeah, I know. Sorry about
let me see if I can try and unpick a little of it. I have all the time in the world for people who feel that they would prefer to be known by geography rather than color.
Yes.
So some people would prefer to be known as African, or Jamaican, or Barbadian, or Caribbean, rather than the colour. So I'm up for that conversation. However, what I'm getting at is is taking ownership of oneself.
Yes.
Being at ease with oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I like it or not, I am of dark hue.
Mm-hmm.
My skin color is dark. Whether a European likes it or not, their skin color is light.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about black and white.
Yes.
Very approximate terms, because
mm-hmm.
nobody's genuinely black and nobody's genuinely white.
White, yes.
So we're talking approximations here.
Mm-hmm.
But the challenge that we're facing is that those people who have dark skin have been pilloried over the last 500-600 years by an elitist and racist regime that has said anybody with one drop of, you know, on white blood is black. And those people have been sort of driven, they're the majority in the world, but they've been kind of pushed in a corner. And with that being pushed in a corner come a whole range of pejorative descriptions about what it means not to be white.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over that time, many of us have drank that bitter water, and it has infected us. So that what happens is we look on our dark skin, and some people are repelled by it. Some people are trying to escape it. But my message is, you cannot escape who you are. Before, somehow you have to stop imbibing the negativity which has been thrown at us over the last 500-600-700 years, which makes many people miserable and wish they were something and somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to start to own and love ourselves, contrary to what the world around us, the dominant world around us, might be saying to us. And so, for me, I'm not so much wanting to deny those who would say, well, I prefer to be regarded as African or Caribbean or whatever. What I am saying, though, is that you have a dark skin and you want to own that and love it and you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I said, again, I agree with that what you've presented there, and I believe we really as a people should own our origins and in a sense our very nature and stuff like that, and walk proudly in it, because again at the start of your book you talked about all of us being, you know, made by the Creator, and we shouldn't really, I guess, discriminate one against the other, especially on the basis of, you know, the color.
Well, indeed, and as you know, from having looked at the book, not just this chapter, but other chapters too, I am making the case that there is no reason why we should seek to run away from ourselves and the difference, nor should we try to minimize it. And some people say, oh, well, I don't see color, for example. So, you know, they don't mind being described by the, I don't know, the shape of the nose or by where they come from or the, you know, or the color of their clothes, but they don't want to be described by the color of their skin. Well, I'm merely saying, if you look around in the created order, what you see are varying colors and shapes and sizes, and I want to make a case for, in the same way that none of us would want a garden with just one kind of flower in it, you know, I just want red in my garden, the world that God has created is full of colors and shades, and there's absolutely no reason why we should run away from that and not own it and celebrate it.
Yeah,
You know, that's really the point I'm making. This is part of God's ecosystem, part of God's diversity, and I am part of that. But because people have heaped adversity and upon us and have heaped almost shame upon us, you know, it's become that we want to take our own odyssey away from the me and the we that God has created. And I'm just saying, no, that actually is not only the racist that is, according to Desmond Tutu, spitting in the face of God when they somehow try to argue or behave as though black is to be despised.
Mm-hmm.
But black people ourselves, when we don't look in the mirror and love and own what we see, we too are spitting in the face of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, and endorse that 100%. I'm of the same view. But in terms of the battle, because I believe that the book and this article also, because as you said, they were standalone pieces that have been compiled together, really begins to set out a strong argument, one, I believe, for, educating our people. And it's in that context of educating, because I think with education, hopefully people like yourselves and other people doing leading works like yours would help to change that perception. But there is no doubt that there is a type of behavior still associated with, the word black. Again, you made reference to your book, in the book about some of the black individuals, male or female, who might have made it to the top in whichever industry they're in, and then they, in terms of how they move socially, they may go and hook up with, you know, a white partner or whatever it is. But again, it's clearly an education thing, but I think there's an education on both sides of the fence, because the whites still operate out of the fact that black is negative, black is bad, black do bad things. What other advice and what other thoughts and plans that you can share, Dr. Bishop, about how we can further advance, build on what forms the foundation here in terms of your own argument? Because I think the battle is a hearts and minds one.
Where you've come to rest there is precisely where I start.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the great Bob Marley said, emancipate yourself from mental slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is that until in our minds we are liberated to be who we are, we will never actualize it in the literal world. It starts in the mind. I wonder if I can read you and your listeners just a few lines from the book.
Yes. Of course, you can.
In that chapter that you're referring to, the first one, Black,
yes.
I Certainly Am.
Yes.
May I say that on page 15,
mm-hmm.
at the bottom, that the battle over racism is never going to be won in the courthouses of this world,
mm-hmm.
necessary as court action may be when people break the law. It will be won in the minds of people. Black people must be the first to win this battle, and we will then in other words, we will win the battle when psychologically we have inner and self-love based upon self-acceptance.
Yes.
Where no one succeeds in offending us by calling us black, darkening white faces, wearing dreadlocks, wigs, scratching their armpits, or throwing bananas.
Mm.
You know, my point is that we have to, this is not so much a white people's issue, because as I make clear in the book, I do not believe that there will ever come the time when there will be no racism in the world.
You're absolutely right on that one.
And therefore, black people have to make a decision. Are we going to live in a world where we will be forever offended by people who say things about us based on the color of our skin? Because if we don't psychologically move on from there, then as I say, you know, why should the racist give up that gig when you know that you the Achilles heel of the person across the way?
Yeah.
You'll use it forever and the day. And yeah. And what I am saying is I think we have to get to the point in our consciousness, in our minds, where somebody calling us black is made to look ridiculous.
Yes, yes.
By our response, which is a response that says, you are really silly. Everybody can see I've got dark skin. What do you think you are achieving by calling me dark?
Mm,
You know, are you stupid or what? But instead, and again, as I say, not sure which chapter of the book, I argue that the dumbest, the most inarticulate white person who is a racist, I don't mean all white people are racist, but I mean, you know, a white racist, they could be the dumbest, most inarticulate person, really. They have the potential to bring the brightest, most articulate black person to shambles by reference to our skin color.
Yes, it's in the same chapter one.
That should never, ever happen, is my point.
Mm.
Why? You only give... My brother, my eldest brother, told me some time ago that he left church, you know, kind of in rebellion, and he only went back, he said, because of mother. He said, my mother made me go back.
Yeah,
it wasn't that I got converted or anything, but my mother made me go back because she embarrassed me about the life I was leading.
Mm.
And so he said he went back to church. Why? Because he respects his mother.
Yes.
Now, my argument is simply this, that you should never, you or I, or anybody else, should never give that kind of respect to anybody, give that kind of power to anybody who don't deserve it. And a racist certainly does not deserve to have any power over me.
Mm.
I ain't giving them not even a scintilla of that power over me by being able to call me a name and suddenly I turn to jelly. Why?
Yes.
No, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, and again, I think we need to have more role models and people standing up to demonstrate this, even amongst our community. I mean, in that chapter there, you spoke of Lewis Hamilton's experience, the Formula One driver. I think in recent times we've had the experience of another sporting star, Tiger Woods.
Well, his is quite funny. I'll tell you why I think his is quite funny. Because Tiger Woods has gone out of his way to say that he's not black.
Yes, yes, yeah, I'm aware of it.
He's gone out of his way to disassociate himself from the black, from blackness.
Mm-hmm.
So why should he be offended when Sergio Garcia makes an inference to something which is of particular relevance, it seems, to African Americans?
Yes.
And this is part of my point in some of the chapters in this book,
mm-hmm.
that if you regard being black as a negative, then of course you are going to be offended when somebody uses it against you.
Mm.
Because you are in a flight away from it. And if you're a Tiger Woods who says, you know, I'm not black, don't call me black, I'm not African American, then it almost makes no sense to then say somebody made a jibe at me with an inference to African American and I am offended.
Yeah.
There is no integrity in that argument.
Yes. I mean, that's also the point, and that's why I talked about role models, because indeed in the one instance he's saying he's not black, and then in the other instance He seems to have brushed it off completely, but then he says, you know, I thought it was inappropriate and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, it may be inappropriate. Listen, I think, again, I'm making the case that our people, people of darker hue, have to grow in our mental psyche and maturity to the point where we live above giving power to people who would try to abuse us in that way.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, I've seen so. You know, have you ever seen? You imagine a king, you know, riding in his or a queen in her realm.
Yes.
And somebody walks up and calls her a name, you know, and so on. I mean, you can. She would swat it away like a fly. you really can't. In fact, you wouldn't even be allowed to approach her.
Exactly.
People insult the queen all the time, you know, with comedy, with whatever. You never see the queen taking action against them necessarily about, you know, trying to insult her.
Exactly.
It's a different issue, of course. They start taking pictures of people when they're naked and so on. That's a different issue altogether.
Yes.
Trying to abuse her about being queen, she would never take them to court. Why? Because she's above that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we need to live psychologically, spiritually, above that kind of nonsense of somebody being free to make a joke at my expense about my being black, and I am going to get mortally wounded. My soul is going to be seared with a hot iron. I'm saying, well, listen, I am never, ever going to give you that over me.
Mm. Mm. So, I think we can safely say then, or I think what you're saying is that it matters not who, you know, who first called us blacks or anything like that, but it really matters how we respond, our
absolutely.
Attitude. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you've summed it up in a nutshell. Because at some point or the other, you know, we may be called something else.
Mm,
So it's not about what we are called so much as about owning self and loving the self and psychologically rising above giving people the freedom to abuse you. You know, you remember the time when people used to be able to call people, you know, a bastard.
Yes.
You know, because
yes.
you were born out of
wedlock. Yep.
And that was seen as extremely abusive and so on. These days, if you use the term, to most people, even if they were born out of wedlock, it carries very little weight.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
sociologically, we've moved on
exactly
from that place.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying to my fellow black folks of African heritage or Asian heritage who have darker skin, don't swallow that bitter pill of self-hate which has been prescribed for us by scientists over the last 400, 500, 600, 700 years who talk about us having small brain. We got thick lip, we got flat nose, we're lazy, da 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 da. Don't swallow that pill. Give it back to the doctor. Say, you swallow it, mate.
Yeah.
Swallowing that. I am a person made in the image of God.
Mm.
I reflect part of God's diversity and beauty in the world, and you will never shift me from that perspective on who I am and also who you are.
Okay. One other thing I want to cover on that particular issue. I mean, it's huge, and we can't really cover it completely, but I just want to make one other comment that I'd like your response to. And this is the whole thing about, I think, recently, maybe 6 to 8 months ago, there was an article in one of the newspapers, and I think it alluded to exactly that, the intelligence of the black people. I think it was in the Daily Telegraph or some the Telegraph or some one of the broadsheets. But the question was, it was from a renowned scientist or group of scientists, and this was the statement. And I must say, you know, I did not see the kind of reaction that I thought we would have seen, if not from the wider community, definitely from the black community, or at least on that scale, are we doing anything to address issues like that in terms of countering it with another something? Yeah.
Sure. I think sometimes we give credence to people and thoughts that do not deserve the credence of a response. Now, I know it's a fine line, because in the same way that what I've referred to as pseudo-scientists sowed seeds into the European psyche that we are superior, and people from Africa are inferior, and people have swallowed it and believed it on both sides.
Exactly. Yeah.
It is possible that somebody with a professor or a doctor before their name can sow similar wild oats into the environment and pollute the air. You know, it is possible. And so we've got to watch that. But it's the nature of the fight that I am particularly interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to respond to people like those in a frenzy of embarrassment and feeling degraded, you know, and so on. No, I would like to respond to him or her in a state of humanity that says, my friend, you really don't know what you're talking about.
Yes.
And it's not to be responded to in a defensive kind of manner that says, you have mortally offended me. How dare you say such a thing?
Okay, yeah.
No. It's an ideological battle that we're into.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want to engage with him on that intellectual, psychological plane.
Mm-hmm.
These are ideologies. And I think what needs to happen is that black folk need to rise to the ideological contest that there is in the world.
Yeah,
you know, when you used to watch the Tarzan films, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
And you'd see the cowboys with their guns, and then you see the few little people come to running at them with sticks. You know, and you know, well, this is a very unequal game because you know, a man with a stick and a man with a gun. Well, I can tell you who is going to win.
Exactly.
And very often our response to racism is, in my view, the equivalent of the man with, or the army with tanks and grenades and machine guns, and us feeling really inferior because all we've got are some little bow and arrows and some sticks.
Yes.
What we need to do is to arm ourselves psychologically, mentally, spiritually, with the appropriate tools to fight the battle. Too often we are in retreat as soon as those things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seen as victim, and we perceive ourselves as victim. And therefore all we can say, you know, we're shouting, croaking, take your foot off my neck. Basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, well, no, get up, stand on your feet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Relate to this as another human being full of God-given integrity, not as some negative person lying on the floor waiting, please take your foot off my neck.
We truly got to stand.
And we don't need to beg. We don't need to beg for that. That is a position at the table of God that we have by right, and we should live there. That's where we should live. And mentally meet us. That's what they should see. Yeah, they're not just meeting a black person or an Asian person. They're meeting another human being.
Mm. All right. I've got another quick question for you.
Sure.
Well, I guess two questions in one. One, based on all that we've said, because we've mainly looked at the identity of the black individual, and how they should be presenting themselves. But obviously, the issue of racism, it stretches beyond the identity in the sense of, you know, the facets of life, and
yes,
it does affect us in. Again, you talked in the book about racism or rethinking racism in the church.
Yeah.
And then further on, you talked about the black theology.
Yeah.
I guess my question is there systematic institutional racism still in the church? And is black theology, first of all, what is that? And secondly, is that a tool that we can use or have been using?
Well, the first part of the question is institutionalized racism still in existence in the church?
Mm.
The answer is yes.
Mm.
And you know, you've only to talk to an Anglican clergy or some aspiring Anglican or Methodist or Baptist in this country about how difficult it is to navigate your way through ministerial accreditation, for example, and just, you know, when you look at these organizations and you say, right, you've got 20% black membership, we would expect to see that 20% resonating right the way through your organization in terms of leadership at all levels and so on. Well, the answer is you don't see that in reality, and therefore you ask the question, why not? And you can only say, well, that is because the organization is still institutionally racist. It mitigates against people of color from rising through the ranks.
Mm.
Now, I would say that the way to tackle that is precisely in the same way that I'm suggesting for society at large,
yes,
which is for the black people in those churches to stand upright,
mm-hmm,
to get off their knees, those who are on their knees, stop begging, you know, give me a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Live as though, because it is the case, God has given you a place at that table by right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, live that way. Live that way. You're not begging for nothing. The Church of England don't belong to white people. The Church of England is part of God's church.
Yes.
And therefore, you know, nobody should feel I can't apply for that job because only white people can do it or only white people can get it. You know, you should be storming every single portal that there is from a position of I belong here.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid much of what goes on is that kind of passive, docile, please let me in, please give me a go, please may I, sir, you know, and we're waiting for the time when a benevolent ruler, you know, gives us a go. Well, you know, there's a truism in the world that power is never given, it is always taken.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you don't pose a threat to the next guy, he won't pay you not a bit of notice because he's already got the power that you think you want,
yeah,
and you're not threatening him. So how do you threaten? Well, you threaten. You know, Jesus says that the kingdom of God it suffers violence, and the violent take it by force.
Exactly.
Well, you know, not necessarily about guns and grenades.
Yeah.
It's about power. It's about
mm-hmm.
power.
Mm-hmm.
You have to equip yourself to storm those bastions of power.
Mm.
And you do it by qualifying yourself, but you also do it, I think, mainly by the mentality that you have, which says, I am not a beggar in this house. I am equally a citizen. No more strangers, no more foreigners, but equal citizens, according to Ephesians or Galatians. We're one in this house, and I am going to behave towards you as though that is how I am in this house. I think more Anglicans, more Baptists, more Methodists, black folk need to have that mindset. To oppose racism. Racist structures must feel your weight and feel your power,
So,
not just your appease, not just your begging. You know, please give me a go. And you asked about black theology.
Yes.
You know, I have been very much involved in the black theology project in this country for the last, I said, 17, 18, 20 years. We've done some astonishingly good things. Not least, we have produced some real stars in terms of scholars, the Anthony Redd's of this world, the Robert Beckford's of this world are some of the main headliners.
Yes.
But there are others, you know, doing theology. We have a number of people now who have black folks who have come out of university with their BAs, their masters, their PhDs, and are moving forward. So we have a number of black folks who are doing well. However, one of my disappointments with black theology is that I think it has operated in a too narrow a vein. So the black theology that we have engineered in this country has tended to want to focus only on trying to deal with oppression,
mm-hmm.
oppression of black people. And so it's a theology of liberation.
Yeah.
You know, it's this oppression-liberation dialectic that has mm-hmm. been its speciality. Well, some people, and I'm one of them, argue that black theology need to be more than a response to white oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Black theology ought to be about black flourishing. How can we flourish? Jesus said, I've come to give you life and life in its abundance. How can I adopt a theology about my life that liberates me to be everything that I should be and can be? Well, from a black perspective, I am saying that is black theology. How can a person who is a black person living in a predominantly white society, what do we need to do to flourish? Some of that will be about oppression. Some of it will be about racism. But some of it will be about what do I need to do to be a good husband, a good father,
yes.
a good friend, a good brother, from a black perspective, with all of my history and my tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't all about oppression, liberation. So I guess one of the pleas I'm making to my colleagues in the Black Theology Project is to see black theology as a wider project than just dealing with white oppression.
Okay.
And one that deals with black flourishing. And by the way, that is not another form of racism, because
mm-hmm.
when black folk in mainly white societies or in the world dominated by white power, which is the world in which we live, people are now recognizing that if Africa flourishes, the world flourishes. So when a black person in the white society go after flourishing, not just dealing with historic oppression or even present day oppression,
mm-hmm.
seeing that for what it is, and it does exist and we need to deal with it, but what we are seeing is that actually what I'm about is not just fighting you, I'm about building my own castle over here.
Yes.
And when it's built, I want to invite you to come and have tea with me in it. So I'm about my own flourishing. And that kind of black theology, I think, is going to help us to move forward
mm-hmm.
in a way
mm-hmm.
that the oppression-liberation dialectic, I think, cannot do, even though it has its place as well.
Okay. I guess you made mention of the fact that we need to, when you were addressing the first part of that question, that we needed to break into the existing structures that exist. But how can we do that if we seem to be building structures outside of it? And when I say structures, not necessarily black churches, but simply...
Because, I tell you why, for a simple reason.
Yeah.
You look at what's happening in the churches now.
Mm-hmm.
Because... let me go back. When black folks started arriving in Britain in the 1950s and 60s, and I know there were black people here before that, but when we start arriving in numbers in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and people started to have church, you know, the Church of God of Prophecy or the New Testament Church of God didn't find their churches here, so they started them. They were rounded upon by philosophers, theologians, by people who were studying society, and they were called non-church. They were called sects, you know, and there were pseudo-churches. But those people have stuck at being church. And if you fast forward 60 years, these are now recognized as churches, which are now playing their full part in the propagation of the gospel in this land.
Yes.
But how have they done that? They have got to that place by remaining faithful to building their own structures. And it's an interesting model, I tell you, because I said a while ago, you know, people respect power, respect power. Power does not respect begging,
yeah,
and pleading and special pleading. Power respect power. Now that the black churches have stayed the course, they now own property. They now have people of substance around the place. They can no longer be ignored. So guess what happens? They now begin, in a plural context, to play their parts as another tower, if you like, another lighthouse on the ocean. And that is the answer to your question. How do we contribute if we are apart? The reality is that in a plural world, in a diverse world, you do not have true diversity if the individual parts of that diversity do not have strength.
Okay.
The carburetor in your car has to be a proper carburetor that works.
Yes. Yes.
The tires have to be good tires that work.
Mm-hmm.
The brakes have to be a good brake that works. Nobody's ever going to say about a car that the brake should morph into the carburetor, or the wheel should become the axle.
Mm.
This is Paul's great text in Corinthians and Ephesians about the body. The body is not one, but
exactly,
many, but many. And the individual parts of the body have to find strength in themselves and integrity in themselves, otherwise they cannot play their part in the body.
Yes, yes.
And as long as your carburetor is not working, the rest of the body is not working properly.
Hmm.
We need a good carburetor to know that it is a carburetor and it must behave like a carburetor and it must be a good carburetor. Well, I'm just saying all of us together, the black Christian community in this country has a particular role to play in the body of Christ, and it should see itself in that light, play its part as a part of the whole.
Mm.
But, yeah, but to play your part as a part of the whole, you have to play your part for who you are.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and again, that comes out clearly, I guess, not I guess, but clearly in the book that you've read here, a number of chapters, you know, in terms of engagement and the whole ecumenical significance of Pentecost.
I'm so committed to that cause. I said to people, I am Joe Aldred. I've been brought up in this country in the black church sector from the day I landed here in 1968. I have been taken into the bosom of a black church in Winston Green. I still go there to this day.
Yes.
It has rooted me. It has nurtured me. It has prayed for me. It has rebuked me. It has built me up. It has deconstructed me, put me on my way. I am not some reclusive person because of that, no. Because of that upbringing, because of that strengthening, because of that deepening, I now spend the most of my time working in ecumenical affairs, trying to bring people together.
Yes.
This week, on Tuesday, had a, as I said at the top of this conversation, had an exciting meeting with church leaders and the two Catholic officials, their colleagues.
Yes.
First time that this has ever happened. Who was brokering that meeting? Yours truly.
Wonderful.
Where was I brought up? In a black church.
A church, exactly.
But has that led me to be myopic? Has that made me too narrow-minded? Has that led me to be a hater of other people? Absolutely not.
Mm.
What it has done for me, it has helped me to be a strong individual, so that I can now play my role across any sphere. I mentioned I was preaching in Geneva the other day. The congregations I went to speak to, 40 different nationalities, was predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there over the weekend. I spoke Friday night, three times Saturday, three times Sunday. I, a black boy, born and bred in Jamaica till I was 16, come to England as a boy, lived all of my Christian life in a black church setting. But God has enabled me from that depth, a bit like a tall coconut tree, to have my roots, but I can feed the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not have been that person had I not had the sucker that I have had from the people who still pray for me to this day in that church that I'm talking about. So I'm absolutely convinced about the model. The model is we are one, but we are not all the same.
Exactly.
And we must not try all to be the same. And
mm-hmm.
as one of the chapters in the book, I talk about, you know, how some of us as black people can only relate to a white image of Jesus.
Yes.
Or in Bible terms, we only relate to the King James Version.
Yeah.
We too quickly get sucked into this sameness. No. We mustn't do that. We must remain the peculiar people that God has made each of us.
Mm-hmm.
Peculiar congregation that God has made each congregation. Be strong in yourself, and then remember that you have a part to play in the wider world that God has placed you in as a part of.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you said there, because just as a point of note, I guess a bit of trivia, it was interesting that I went around, well, for the longest while, I've been looking for a painting of the Last Supper.
Madonna.
No, the Last Supper,
uh-huh.
but with black people,
right,
or people of color.
Yes.
In it, but I can't seem to find anywhere. And again, I think it just underlies the fact that you mentioned definitely in your book and the fact that we've been sold a lie, but we need to stand up above and beyond it. Yeah. I want to ask you probably one other quick question. Two other. I don't know how you're gonna do it. You don't have a lot more time, but one, you talked about the prosperity theology that is preached. And I wanted to know, particularly if it plagues the black community only, and if that is the case, what are we doing, or what are you aware of? What projects are you aware of as us as a black community empowering ourselves economically?
Well, there aren't enough. You know, one of the challenges that we have as a community in this country is that the African diaspora, the Caribbean diaspora in this country, we are not economically strong.
Yes.
There are exceptions, of course, as
of course.
Always.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But as a people, we are not economically strong. We are not politically strong.
Mm-hmm.
Either. We are reasonably culturally quite strong, you know.
Yes.
Some people reckon, you know, that the Caribbean kind of a dialect in London is the lingua franca, you know.
Yeah.
We set the tone.
Exactly.
We need to transfer that, you know, and our prowess on the athletics field, we need to transfer that into the political and the economic spheres.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the churches, the black churches, black majority churches, are in the main economically quite strong, at least in building terms, you know, a lot of property around the country. But that is not strong enough to influence the wider black community. I think there are reasons for that. If you look back at the people from the Caribbean who came to this country back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, most of us came from rural lives, self-sustaining rural existence. And we came to this country and we went into the cities, but we did menial stuff. In the main, doctors didn't come to drive buses. So you had a particular class of people that came in response to the call to come and help rebuild the country.
And
there are a few exceptions, but it's taken us, you know, till now, 65 years later since the Windrush, to be developing a more plural community, black community.
Mm-hmm.
know, you can see the emergence, if you like, of a sort of middle class, a black middle class in Britain, and a political class, and a business class, and so on. So it's happening very, very slowly. And I think we just have to keep on encouraging those instincts, because they will come. They will come. In the book, I talk about the situation in a little town in America, which is largely black run, sort of 98% black, and everybody, you know, black people run everything. I think we are slowly emerging out of that monolithic kind of working class black existence in this country into a more diverse black community, and with that will come more business people, more economic and political prowess and clout. But 65 years in many respects is not a very long time for a people to evolve into becoming the diverse people that we need to be. So I think the steps ahead, A, for us not to get too impatient with ourselves, B, for us to encourage those things that we know we need to encourage, young people get a good education, whether it's vocational or more dryly academic, young people to having got education, those who can go on to university, get a trade, and so on, go into business, don't just look for employment for people to employ you, but think about how you yourself might generate business yourself. And so I think we just need to keep on encouraging a more pluriform response to we have our challenges, Duane, as you know. What we've seen on our streets this past week reminds us that we have some serious challenges out there.
Yes.
You know, these two young men who committed this heinous crime in London are two, and if we're not careful, we feel ourselves, when it is projected upon us, that is all that we are.
Exactly.
That is not all that we are. That is a part of our reality, but it's not all of who we are. And therefore, we have to deal with our challenges, but we have to also, as the good book says, strengthen the things that remain.
Exactly.
I love how you put that. Little fires into a flame. And I have to tell you, with all the realities of what's around us, I am also quite encouraged by much of what I see in terms of business, in terms of politics and so forth. So, you know, it will take a while. Maybe I won't be here when, you know, it comes to full bloom. But, you know, I think we just have to keep on encouraging.
Exactly, yeah, I think before Duane goes to his next question, I think it's a good place for you to interject about the National Church Leaders Forum and their political agenda.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, a piece of work which some of us have been doing is trying to encourage the what we're calling the black church, of course not entirely black as we all know, but the black church to become more politically active and encourage a greater sense of politics in the church and out of the church. And we are we set about last year engaging in a series of conversations with different people, activists, young people, ministers, about what people feel politically are our main challenges and hopes. And we are pulling that together in a manifesto, a black church political manifesto, that we want out in good time before the next election. And Dr. David Muir is our main writer of it, and he has promised us that by the end of July, he will have the first draft of this manifesto. And we hope that when it is done and dusted, I mean, when it comes out at the end of July, we are going to then push it out into the communities. You will definitely see it. And we'll be asking for comments so that we can further develop it and finish it. Certainly, we hope by the end of this year, well in time. So that should help the churches to focus, have a tool to guide in the development of a political agenda for not just itself and not just for black people, in fact, but for our part within the country that we live. So keep an eye out, everybody, for that it's coming soon.
Yes, yes. I guess some a closing question, and that is, you know, it is clear, Bishop, that you have a message. And if you could sum that up in a sentence, what is your main message? Jesus' message, we know. You know, the kingdom of God is here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What is your message?
My message is based very much on the kingdom message, you know, that
yes.
In the kingdom is a diverse kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
John in Revelation talk about Revelation 7. I think talk about being caught up into heaven, and there around the throne of God, he saw all peoples of all languages, all nationalities, everybody was there. So my view is that, and the message I give, is that all of us in the kingdom belong equally in the kingdom.
Yes.
But the kingdom is one, but it's not all the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And everybody, according to Paul in Ephesians, everybody make up this body, and in Corinthians. And the body is not one, it's many.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, because the body is not one but many, all of us in it must take our place and understand that we have a place there by right. And we must refuse to make people fit us into a little box of their own choosing. But as in the title of my book, Thinking Outside the Box, it begins in our minds. The Bible talks about the renewing of our minds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's where it starts. It starts with our thinking about who we are, where we are, who other people are in relation to us. And so my message is that message about don't think the way you have been conditioned to think. Think outside the box. When you come to thinking about yourself, when you come to thinking about church, when you come to thinking about society,
mm-hmm.
don't conform to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of the mind, and in that way we transform ourselves and we transcend people's low expectations, because we don't see ourselves through their eyes, but through God's eyes that have made us all equal.
Mm-hmm. Good. That then brings us to asking, what is the big picture? And this is from a leadership perspective. You've already spoken of the Black Church and their agenda and the political manifesto. But is there a bigger picture in terms of, I mean, because the challenges we face are simply not targeting the Black community.
Not at all. No, Will, listen, the big picture is...
There is a leadership vacuum, though, I guess.
There is, but it's also a vacuum of vision. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was in London today listening to Alistair McGrath talking about apologetics, Christian apologetics, you know.
Yes.
And I got into conversation with a brother there whilst we were there. And I was saying to him that the issue for us is about vision.
Yes.
It's about vision. And if you don't have a vision, you know, is it Psalm or is it Proverbs 29 that says, where there is no vision,
exactly,
people perish. Another translation says, where there is no law, the people cast off restraint.
Right. Yes.
So if there's no guiding principle, then of course everybody just do what is right in their own eyes. And for me, the big picture is of a God who, in my ecumenical language, ecumeny of God is the one that God is cohering in the world, a world that is one world united in its many parts. And so the big picture is that God is pulling all this together, but he's got each of us as part of that big picture. And my job is to be, as I said earlier, all that I can be. It's maximizing me and those around me that I can influence, so that we can play our part in the actualizing of the world, that God, the kingdom that God is building. Jesus pray, Father, let the kingdom come. You know, thy kingdom come on earth. And God is in charge of that big kingdom picture of a world where there is peace, where there is prosperity, where the lion and the lamb lie down together. That's the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
But within that picture, my role is to be all that I can be.
Exactly.
And I must not let anybody's prejudices put me out of being all that I can be. So the big picture, you know, you can't cure the world, but you can cure your little part of it.
Exactly.
And it's not your job to cure the entire world. You just have to look after the bit that God has given you to look after.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. God, the master builder, who is building this great edifice, is saying, you don't have to worry about the entire picture, but you must understand that that's where I'm going, where everything is reconciled. You reconcile you, and you reconcile where you are, and play your part. And when you play your part, and everybody plays their part, God's majestic program of a world of peace and love and joy, in which not everybody will be a part, because there will be some people who choose the opposite. But those who choose life can live that life in the world and continue to be salt of the earth. So that's the big picture.
Yes. Again, Dr. Aldridge, we really thank you for your time. And indeed, I can affirm that indeed you're one of the master builders that I believe God has raised up for our generation. So continue that good work.
We do our best,
that good work, yeah.
We do the best we can. And of course, I want to encourage folks, as you said earlier, to get a copy of this book that we have just published. Can I just say where folks can find it?
Yes, you can, of course.
Yeah. It's appearing now on the
Amazon
on the internet, and Amazon is saying that they've got a 1st of November date.
Yes.
For when they will begin to deliver, so people can pre-order. But on my own website, my WordPress site, I won't say who has built it, but on my own WordPress site at www.respectenterprises.com/WP, people will find all the information they need about how to order the book.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Great to be on your program again.
Thank you very much, Bishop Aldridge. It's always a pleasure to have you. And I know the book, I believe it has 212 pages, according to the details, but I think we can have a show on every chapter if we put our minds to it.
Thank you. Yes. God bless you and all your listeners.
You too. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good night.
Good night. Yes, you've been listening to Together in Ministry Blog Talk Radio, and we had on the line with us Bishop Joe Aldridge, and he was talking about his book Thinking Outside of the Box. And as he said, you can get a copy of the book from his website. It's respecenterprises.com/WP, and you'll find all the details there. Now it's going to be on Amazon, and as usual, you can get access to it from our website, which is www.togetherinministry.org. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Remember, all our shows are recorded and could be found on the same website address that I gave you just now. If you're looking for a particular show, there's a search button on there that you can use to search for any one of the shows. And you can type in Joe Aldridge, which we've had him a few times on the show, and you can listen live from there. Thank you again for joining us. Do have a great weekend. Dwayne, do you want to say anything before we close off?
No, just that as we've been talking tonight and in some of our previously recorded chinwags, identity is key. I would say to you, if you're asking yourself the question, who am I, why am I here, I think to start with, those are good questions to ask yourself. And you can definitely log into our website and you'll get some information on all of this.
Yes. Oh, before we go, I'd like to mention a conference that we have coming up, and it is on the 10th of August. This is hosted in conjunction with some of the churches, but Together Ministry being the main host, and we'll be talking at the conference about spiritual parenting. And we have two special guest speakers, Apostle John Noble and Apostle Malcolm Sobers. Again, that's the 10th of August. If you go to our website, you will find a link to that conference. It's going to be at the Grove Center Church, and you can find more information on the website, as I said. It's www.togetherinministry.org. Do tune in again next week at the same time, 8 o'clock GMT time, for another episode of Together in Ministry Blog Talk Radio. God bless you, keep you, cause His light to shine upon you, give you rest, give you peace, give you joy, give you your heart's desire. Don't forget, if you are not a member of a regular local church, you can send us an email at info@togetherinministry.org, and we can direct you to one of our friends or partner churches in your local area. So send us an email if you have any comments. We love from our listeners. It's really amazing to hear from you. So God bless you. Goodbye now.
Goodbye.